Hi, this is Ian Pickus. We are back in the Congressional Corner today with our old friend David Hawkins, a contributing author for the Almanac of American Politics. He has spent a lifetime covering Congress, and he has joined us on the Congressional Corner many times over those years. David, welcome back.
It's a thrill to be back, Ian.
So is the Almanac of American Politics being rewritten right now?
Well, it gets rewritten every 2 years. Because, you know, politics is a changing business. What it is profiles of every federal elected official from Donald Trump down to, Nick Langworthy, or not front page news congressman. I actually got assigned to do the entire New York delegation, so that brought me up to speed on what's going on in and around Albany.
Any comers in the bunch in your mind?
Oh gosh, you know, I mean, yes, we could. we could walk right into the future. I mean, everybody's talking about Lawler. He's sort of a flavor of the month in Washington, and everybody wants to know whether he's going to leave Washington to try and be governor or whether he's going to stick around. He's got sort of a good reputation among Republicans in Washington. People think he's a smart messenger and a clever guy to be one of the few what we call split ticket Republicans in the entire Congress. That's a challenge to do in this day and age, and he's pulled it off. So anyway,
and he says he'll have a decision about running for governor by June. Presumably, as you say, he's kind of won in a swing district, one of the few the last couple of times. The next midterms traditionally would be tougher sledding for Republicans. But how has he staked out that sort of middle ground?
Well, it was a challenge to write, right? Because he seems to try and be loyal to the Trump agenda whenever he can, and also try and find ways to, in both great ways and small ways, to stake out a more centrist position wherever can on matters, you know, as small as proxy voting in Congress for new parents. He's actually a new parent. I think it's a second or third child recently came into their family, and he actually bucked the leadership on this seemingly obscure. Why this became a huge fight in Congress, whether new parents who are members of Congress should be able to vote remotely while their babies are brand new. But he bucked Speaker Johnson. He was one of just 12 Republicans to buck the speaker. So he does small things like that. Bigger things like economic policy and budgeting, and then sticks with Trump on lots of social stuff and, of course, Israel. So he's sort of all over the map, and it's he's also very good on television, I think. You know, he puts himself out there on TV all the time, and seems to come up with a punchy way of delivering his points. So that's how he's trying to stand out.
I'll just mention here, he's been on this show before. We've been trying to get him back on a more regular basis. It gets scheduled, it gets canceled. He's got a standing invite anytime he wants, and we'll make that happen. Let's take a quick detour and talk about that proxy voting thing. I found it surprising just that it failed. I mean, usually speakers are pretty good at counting votes beforehand. What did you make of that?
Is a dogged younger generation of Republicans who really, it's a small group, but they're really taking this seriously, and they really don't want, to be in your 30s or 40s and be a young parent to be an impediment to doing your job. But Johnson, that would seem to me simple, but proxy voting became a huge deal during COVID. When it was broadly adopted, right? Congress didn't want too many people crammed into that room, and so they allowed members to vote remotely for sort of as long as they wanted through the pandemic and even after the pandemic ended. And there was some abuse. You were supposed to have a legitimate reason to be away. You were supposed to have a health concern. And even after the pandemic ended, it continued, and there were some members who literally just didn't come to Washington and had somebody else vote for them, which was, kind of a dangerous precedent-setting thing. So the Republicans ran emphatically on we're not going to let that happen anymore. And Johnson felt compelled to stick up for it and really, I think sort of exposed one of the myriad ways in which his speakership is on a knife's edge. You know, it only took, as we probably all said till we're blue in the face, it only takes three or four of his own team to vote against him and he loses.
So let's talk about one of Lawler's colleagues in the New York delegation. The last time you and I had a conversation on this show, we were getting ready for an inevitable special election in northern New York. And, you know, would Democrats have an early comeback in the Trump administration? Well, that's not happening, at least not now. Elise Stefanik will not be the UN ambassador. She's staying in the House. What did you make of that development?
I thought it was a real test, must be a real test of the woman's patience, or malleability. And as you and I have discussed in the past, and maybe I'm out over my skis on this, she has proven herself to be, one of the most malleable politicians I've ever witnessed in the last 20 years, having gone from, a never Trumper to a Trump loyalist during her relatively short career. Now she's asked to be malleable again and take a seat. Because of this, as we were just discussing, these very narrow margins, her vote being essential to Johnson. I guess she's, I think the assumption has to be that she is going to be rewarded over time with not a consolation prize, but a bigger prize. There's already talk now that if you believe Pete Hegseth's tenure is going to be shorter than most other cabinet members, which I think is kind of a good bet. And who knows, by the time this, we're off the phone, he could be gone. I think it's inevitable that he won't last, more than a few months or a few weeks. There's talk of, that they would try and put her back in, or she would leave and run for governor, or she would stick around, run for reelection. I think that's unlikely, and then try and, wait for another administration job down the line. But it is a short-term sacrifice for her that I'm pretty confident she's a smart enough and savvy enough player that she's going to extract a decent price for her sacrifice now later on.
And just to close the loop on that, at the time that the nomination was pulled, there was some reporting that the administration wasn't so confident about a couple special elections in Florida that were scheduled right around the same time. So they were trying to protect the House margin. But those ended up being easy GOP wins. We haven't really seen one of those bellwether special elections early in the Trump term this time around the way we did the first time around, have we?
Well, we haven't. I mean, the Democrats would disagree with you and say, this is the old joke about it only being close only counts in horseshoe and grenades. But but they did come closer in both of those districts than the margins were. It was still easy, but much less easy than normally in either of those districts. They went from, totally deep, deep maroon red to sort of pinkish red in both of those elections. I forget the precise margins. I think it was, it was narrower. So the Democrats still feel like, that they can make a close race out of almost any special election. And with the polling, those elections, gosh, that seems so last month or 2 months ago now. Since then, the president's poll numbers have only gotten worse. So I think any special election that comes up, the Democrats are going to take a run at it. And, of course, yes, it would take three or four, wherever we are now, three or four turnovers to create a Democratic majority. But even without a formal Democratic majority, there are enough, there's a small but pivotal group of, Mike Lawler type Republicans who can make Donald Trump and Donald Trump's agenda go away practically and make Mike Johnson's life trying to manage Donald Trump's agenda very, very difficult. So having a loyalist like Elise Stefanik, one more of those in his back pocket is an important thing at this point.
David, we were talking about the narrow margins that Republicans have in Congress right now, especially on the House side. With GOP total control in Washington, how are things running in comparison to previous Congresses?
Well, I think they're running much more sort of bulkily. That's not really a good word. Much more sort of herky-jerky and tentatively than you would think initially when you hear, oh, Republican trifecta. They got the White House, they got the Senate, they got the House. Things should be humming along. They're not. I mean, as we're talking now, they are only still in the early stages of moving what Trump likes to call the big, beautiful bill, this one gigantic bill that is going to remake the federal government sort of in his image. It's very tentative. It's very slow going. And with each passing day, I think it gets less likely that Trump is going to get all of what he wants. The reason is because, as we discussed the last time, the Republican margin is tiny in the House. It's at less than a handful of seats. And the margin is made. The reason they even have that majority, narrow though it is that there are a handful of Republicans who, there are only three actually Republicans who represent seats that Kamala Harris carried in the 2024 election. But there's a bunch of others that represent areas with, for example, plenty of poor people who don't want Medicaid to be cut, for example. Those who are only tuning into this once in a while might think that the Medicaid cut is already coming. It's not. It hasn't been actually written into the bill yet, into this process yet. My hot take that I hope you mark down as you always do when I say something that's a hot take that turns out not to be true, but maybe I think this will be true, is that in the end, the Republicans will back away from cutting Medicaid because I think those cuts could be the death knell for the Republican majority. And I think there's a pivotal number of Republicans who don't want to do it. And they would rather, the reason to cut Medicaid is to offset increases elsewhere and tax cuts elsewhere. I think the Republicans are more interested in saving their bacon and in protecting their constituents than they are in the debt and the deficit. And so they'll back away from Medicaid cuts and just let the debt get even bigger.
Is that where John Thune is in the Senate, in your mind?
I don't think John Thune has laid out a clear position.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ideological margin in the Senate is a little bit more favorable to Trump. Again, not to bog you down with too much process, I think probably most listeners know that most things that go through the Senate have to muster a so-called supermajority, 60 votes, which means in this case, some members of the Democratic Party need to vote for whatever Trump's going to do. That's not the case for these big budget bills. Those under special circumstances, they're given a special circumstance. They can go through with a majority vote. And I think at the moment, John Thune probably has the votes to advance what Trump wants, almost all of what Trump wants. So I think Medicaid cuts have a better chance of getting through the Senate than the House.
Now, that brings us to a related point here that I want to talk to you about, which is Senator Schumer's standing. He has definitely taken his lumps from Democrats in the past couple of weeks, after, as you say, joining the Republicans to approve a government funding bill. And that was a week where he started saying it won't pass, and he ended by, providing the key Democratic votes for it to pass. So how does Senator Schumer's standing look to you right now, given the backlash that decision inspired among his own party?
So I'm kind of bullish on Chuck Schumer, actually, despite all that. I think that is going to prove to be a fading memory pretty quickly, and that he will, live to fight another day. He will have plenty of other fights to have with the administration. Yet there are, another cliche in politics is you can't beat somebody with nobody. There is not yet somebody who wants to run against Chuck Schumer for Democratic leader. I'm talking about in Congress. You know, I mean, he has, of course, two constituencies. He has the people of New York, who will be asked to vote to reelect him or not in 2028. But more immediately, he has the other Democrats in the Senate who will be asked to return him or remove him as Senate Democratic leader after the next election. At the moment, nobody else is going to be running against him. There are a few Democratic candidates for the Senate, none of which I would describe as top-tier Democrats for the Senate, who have made a point of saying if they're elected, they won't support Schumer to stay on as Democratic leader. But I think his standing in the Senate is going to be fine over time. The Senate is going to have another leadership turnover. Schumer's number two, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, announced a few days ago that he was not going to be running for re-election. He's now, I think he's 80. He's been in Congress for 44 years. He was a House member when I first came. He was a young, but, you know, up-and-comer House member when I first started covering Congress in the late 1980s. So there's going to be a leadership change there. We're going to have a senator from Hawaii named Brian Schatz probably running for that number two job called the whip. Amy Klobuchar may run against him for the whip's job. So that's enough turnover probably for the 2026 midterm Senate leadership. I think Schumer's bigger problem could be if AOC decides not to run for president, but to run for the Senate instead in 2028. Maybe that'd be a bigger problem. But I think she's running for president.
Do you think that Schumer made the right decision at that time to go along and keep the government open? There are different theories about this that, you know, it would, as Schumer argued, had the government closed, it would have accelerated the executive branch power expansion that's already underway. And that was the argument he made. Others said, you know, Democrats don't have any cards to play, but here was one.
Yeah, I guess I'm, you know, as somebody who's been covering Congress now for as long as I have, I probably approach this more in the Schumer way as sort of an institutional problem that Congress has almost totally walked away from its responsibilities at the moment. I mean, you'd have to list them first, Congress generally, first among the people who've allowed Donald Trump's presidency to be as sort of aggressive and intense as it's been, because they're not pushing back in any way. And allowing that government to shut down back then would have only accelerated that. Generally, the polling shows, I mean, that in general on these past shutdown things, the public has sided more with the president than with the Congress. And so I think in the long term this would have worked to Trump's favor. So I think it was as you say, arguable point, but I think on balance, he probably certainly made a strategically defensible decision, maybe even the right one.
There's been a lot of coverage of late of the 100 days polling and how President Trump's popularity is doing. I mean, it seems to me he's never really been all that popular, but he has won a couple of elections. Does it matter if the president's approval rating is hovering around 39% or so?
I don't think it matters now. I think it matters. I think at the moment, the degree of fealty to him among Republicans in Congress remains astonishingly high. We talked last time about, maybe some Republicans won't agree with him on some of the budget matters, but in general, they are remaining extremely loyal to him. I think in the main, that is going to continue through the 2026 election. And they're going to stick with him. They've stuck with him for so long on so many different matters that I think the only thing at this point that could change that is if they lose the House in 2026, if they get clobbered and they're in the minority, then they will finally their self-preservation gene, which is their politicians, you know, self-preservation is job one. Right now, up until now, they've thought sticking with Trump was the key to self-preservation. If after the 2026 election, his popularity is super low and he's a lame duck, and he doesn't persist in all this, I would describe as dangerous talk about running for a third term, I think only then might they walk away from him.
David, we've been talking about the White House, we've been talking about the Congress, but we have not talked about the judicial branch that much in this new Trump term. How is the Supreme Court approaching the Trump administration and its moves so far?
Well, so far, I would say the phrase kid gloves comes to mind. It seems as though, the court has gone, has done an interesting job of trying to allied or skirt most of the things that have come to it early in the Trump administration. They have issued tentative, narrow procedural rulings on almost everything that they've touched that has had to do with the early 100 or so days of the Trump administration. They're not going to be able to do that for too much longer, however. There are a couple of cases headed their way that they have agreed to decide so-called on the merits and not on some sort of procedural ground. Birthright citizenship, I think, is one that many Americans can, many listeners can sort of understand. It's kind of simple. The president essentially is arguing that the 14th Amendment is not quite as clear-cut as it seems to be to many others, which says that if you're born in the United States, you are a citizen. He seems to think there's a way around it. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear that argument. That will be a pretty clear test of how assertive he can be with his executive orders. But up until now, not the sort of conservative, the fear of Trump's detractors has been, his six-vote supermajority and the three people he put on the court are going to be with him every time. They're going to allow him to do whatever he wants. It hasn't been quite that way. And most notably, his final appointee to the court, Amy Coney Barrett, has kind of stuck some surprising, if not outright dissents, then has sort of signaled ways in which she thinks some of what President Trump's been doing has been a bit of an overreach.
With a few months in, we've talked on this show in the past, especially since November, about your concerns that Trump is moving the country in an authoritarian direction and eroding democracy. Do you see that happening over the first 100 days?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. I think. And some of you're going to ask me for some examples, and it's sort of blindingly overwhelming. I think clearly his wave of executive action, he has pushed the bounds at almost every turn. As I said on the last time we talked, he continues to say, I think this is maybe the most obvious one, is this talk about running for a third term. He says, joking, not joking. He said it now often enough, and he said, I'm not joking often enough, that I think this should be a major concern to the country, that the president would try and do a constitutional workaround to stay in power beyond the two-term limit. Yes, of course, he understands that power goes away when you're a lame duck, and he doesn't ever want to be perceived as a lame duck. But I think even talking about this is a dangerous flirtation with autocracy. That looms large in my thinking about him. And that goes beyond, the daily assertions of executive of powers that don't normally belong to presidents, powers that flaunting of democratic norms, abuse, I would say, of the First Amendment, if not an outright violation of the First Amendment, the way he has treated the Associated Press, for example, in not allowing them full participation in their historic role. And I would use the word historically important role to have one news agency with the president at every step. And to change that, gets him down the slippery slope of trying to manipulate the press in a very undemocratic way.
Where does all of that leave J.D. Vance, who obviously is the number two? And if we assume that, you know, this administration does play by the rules of America, you know, he would be the presumptive GOP torchbearer going forward.
That's true. And not to go too far down the Trump third term rabbit hole, but he would also, the constitutional workaround that Trump would seemingly be likeliest to try is to switch places on the 2028 ticket with Vance and actually have Vance be the torchbearer, be the nominee in 2028. And then they'd pull a switcheroo, and after they win the election, so this theory goes, Vance would be president, you know, for a day or two, and then would resign and let Donald Trump ascend from the vice presidency back to the presidency. Crazy stuff, but you know, stranger things seem likelier to happen. He's clearly. I mean, of course, Donald Trump has sort of frozen the Republican field for 28, which otherwise would normally be, you know, a bubbling, roiling cauldron of intrigue if we knew that the guy was a lame duck. But, you know, who are the Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, Ron DeSantis, all names you've probably heard of, except, I guess, Josh Hawley, who would be the new one on that list. All those folks would normally, who want to be, clearly want to be president, would be giving speeches and going to New Hampshire and appearing at rubber chicken dinners and, you know, putting their name out there. But they're not, at least overtly. And, of course, neither is J.D. Vance because, well, he doesn't really have to, but they're all kind of frozen waiting for and he, Donald Trump, could keep talking about this idea of sticking around deep into 2028 and really, or 2027, maybe even 2028, and really screw things up for the race to succeed him.
Well, we saw not exactly something like that happen on the Democratic Party's ticket the last time around, but a late decision does roil the race, that's for sure. So who would stop that chain of events from happening? I mean, you know, presidents have, especially in our lifetimes, just operated under the rules of the Constitution and known that the second term is it. If he decides to ignore that, who stops it?
Who stops it? Yeah, I've tried to do a little reporting on this, and I think there's a lot of head scratching. I suppose there is one scenario where if he actually puts his name on the ballot in some, tries to put his name on the ballot in some primaries in 2028, voters in one of those states could, in theory, sue and get it before the Supreme Court, which could rule before the election. The theory being that if you're not qualified to be president, then you're not qualified to be on the primary ballots either. Is the theory there? Now, I'm going down this rabbit hole, but so there's another provision. So on my switcheroo thing, right, where you have put Vance up as president, Trump up as vice president, and then they do the switcheroo. What's to stop that is another, some legal scholars say, another provision in the Constitution that essentially says if you're not qualified to be president, if you don't meet the qualifications to be president, then you don't meet the qualifications to be vice president either. So there are some legal scholars who say that would rule out the switcheroo. Anyway, I think what could stop it is if some aggrieved voters could somehow persuade the courts to take this up in advance of the election and rule in advance of the election that this won't work. But I'm not sure that there's been enough study or writings on this that that can be said with certainty.
Interesting times to live in, and David Hawkins, we're so grateful for all of your time on the Congressional Corner. He's a contributing author for the Almanac of American Politics. David, we're looking forward to the next round through. You always bring us up to speed. Thanks so much.
I enjoy it, Ian. Thanks.